audience today who has been called upon to assume personal responsibility for the leadership of entire groups or nations. But our distinguished speaker this morning has assumed such responsibilities, and he has done so at a time which was most dangerous for his country, and at a time when there were enormous tensions in the world, as there are indeed at this time. And as a result of his personal efforts, he has been arrested by the Gestapo, he has been imprisoned by the Nazis, he has been forced out of office by the communists, he has spent almost 20 years in exile, he has seen his own 4-year-old son held as a hostage by the communists, and yet he comes to us in a demonstration of courage and patience which I sincerely admire. I think that his courage is matched only by those Hungarian freedom fighters of about 10 years ago, whom we all watched with anguish and with approval as they attempted but failed to wrest independence for their country from their Soviet overlords. Our speaker today comes to us not as a scholar who has investigated the problems, but as a man who has experienced them. While he was Prime Minister of Hungary, he made official state trips to Moscow at the invitation of Joseph Stalin, by the way, and to Paris and London and Washington, also at the request of our government. The Macmillan Company has recognized this in publishing his book, Struggle Behind the Iron Curtain. And since 1948, he has been living near Washington, where he is a member of the Hungarian National Council in exile, president of the International Peasant Union, and chairman of the Assembly of Captive European Nations. He has participated personally in interviews and in international political conferences in Paris, London, Strasbourg, Vienna, Rome, Brussels, Bonn, Tokyo, Karachi, and Geneva. And he has done so in personal contact with the leaders of the world, men like Russia's Molotov, India's Nehru, America's Harry Truman, among others. We welcome him to our convocation this morning. His appearance here today is a part of his effort to regain independence for Hungary and democracy for the world. And in this connection, he has appeared on more than 100 college and university campuses in the United States because he attaches particular importance to presenting his comments to young people in whom he has expressed to me a very profound confidence. I hesitate to say so, but I think that sometimes his confidence, as he expressed it, is even greater than mine. Now, this morning, he is going to speak to us on the subject Central and Eastern Europe today. It is a great honor for me to present Premier Ferenc Nagy of Hungary.
Distinguished guests, members of the faculty, ladies and gentlemen, my dear young friends. First of all, I would like to express my deep appreciation and gratitude for your invitation. I think it would be a great pleasure to anyone, not only for me, to be invited by this great school on this most beautiful campus and with that beautiful program you have. In a school like this, I think it would be an insult to question your knowledge on the geographic location of Central and Eastern Europe and those countries behind the Iron Curtain. But if we want to speak about Central and Eastern Europe as a political unit under communist domination, I think a little description of that area will not do any harm. There are 11 countries, 11 nations behind the Iron Curtain under communist rule, from the Baltic Sea to the Adriatic Sea, between the free Western Europe and the Soviet Union. These nations are belonging, although they are all dominated by communist governments, into several different categories. There are, first of all, the most unfortunate Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, which are incorporated already the Soviet Union, thus deprived even the appearance of independent nationhood. There are two countries in the utmost south of this area, Yugoslavia and Albania, which are belonging again into a different category. And between them, there are East Germany, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania, and Bulgaria, which are called satellite nations. I would like to correct, there are no satellite nations, only satellite governments. The status of Albania and Yugoslavia is different because while in the so-called satellite countries, the leaders were without exception being put in power by the Soviet Union through political or military or both kind of support. In those two grand countries, the leaders, Marshal Tito of Yugoslavia and Enver Hoxha of Albania, weren't put in power directly by the Soviet Union, but they used their guerrilla forces, those with which they were fighting against the Nazi occupation armies, as a militant basis for their communist regimes. So the leaders in those two countries are not personally obligated to the Soviet Union. Consequently, their status is quite different. I must say a few words about the takeover of the Central and Eastern European area by the communists. First of all, I would like to eliminate any kind of belief that those countries were taken over by the Communist Party through the will of the majority of the people. There is not a single country in Central and Eastern Europe where the communist regime was established by the will of the majority of the people. Without exception, as I mentioned, they took over the power by the help of the Soviet Union. Near to the end of the Second World War, the great powers of the victorious alliance came together several times to discuss and to decide about the future of the war-affected countries all over the world. Tehran, Yalta, Potsdam were the most outstanding international conferences in this respect. Most important of them was the Yalta Conference, when through the Yalta Agreement, these great powers decided about the division of the right of occupation in the war-affected countries. The division of the right of occupation followed largely the line of the military achievements of the participating powers. Thus, the United States secured the right to occupy Italy and Japan alone, Germany and Austria together with the other allies. The Soviet Union got the right to occupy the whole Central and Eastern European area. Yalta Agreement gave not only rights to those nations who sent occupation armies in the occupied countries, but there were certain provisions in favor of the occupied nations also in the Yalta Agreement. For example, the occupation armies should have held free elections in the occupied countries as soon as it possible, and they were obligated to help the occupied nations to establish democratic governments and institutions. But the intention, the ideological basis, and the interpretation of the right of occupation did make a great difference between the results of the different occupations. While the countries occupied by the United States and the Western powers were, before and during the war, without exception, dictatorships, Italy under Mussolini, Japan under the Emperor and his clique, Germany and Austria under Hitler, as a result of the American occupation and the American interpretation of the right of occupation, all of them became democratic countries. No one can doubt that those countries, Italy, Japan, Germany, Austria, are indeed democratic countries. All those countries which were occupied by the Soviet Union, although they were either real democracies or at least semi-democracies, as a different interpretation of the right of occupation, became communist dictatorships because the Soviet Union abused the right of occupation to conquest. There is not a single country in Central and Eastern Europe which, even after almost 20 years of communist rule and constant indoctrination efforts, accepted the communist ideology as their political philosophy, as their way of life, as their future ideology. In every country, there is a small minority reduced almost entirely to the actual beneficiaries of the situation, which are the followers of communist ideology. Great majority of the people none of those countries ever accepted communism. I think there is not a single country in Central and Eastern Europe where the percentage of the communists, real communists, would be as high as it is in Switzerland, not speaking about Italy or France, where there are strong communist nations, communist parties. Finally, there is not a single country in the Central and Eastern European area which do not want to get rid of Soviet oppression and communist domination constantly, and do not expecting a certain kind of understanding and help from the part of the West. How the Communist Party succeeded to establish so rapidly, so quickly, communist rules in those Central and Eastern European countries. With the exception of Czechoslovakia, where there was a communist party between the two wars as a parliamentary party, there were no communist parties worthwhile to mention in any of the Central and Eastern European countries. Not only because they were the communist party was outlawed in most of the countries, but because communism just did not appear to those nations. But the Central and Eastern European nations had certain experiences on communism immediately after the First World War. As you know from European history, as a result of the defeat of the so-called Central Powers in the First World War, one of the greatest power in Europe, the Austro-Hungarian monarchy, was entirely dissolved. The dissolution of the Austro-Hungarian monarchy was followed by a temporary chaos. At that time, the Soviet Communist Party was already more than a year old and was in power more than for a year. The Soviet Communists decided to send home those prisoners of war who in the last years became members of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union with the assignment to try to initiate communist movements in their respective countries, taking advantage of the chaos followed the defeat of the Austro-Hungarian monarchy in Germany, or if it's possible, to establish communist governments. More or less, they were successful everywhere to take advantage of the bitterness and chaos in their respective countries, and they were successful to establish smaller or stronger communist parties in Hungary, which was mainly and most than any other country hurt by the dissolution of the monarchy. They succeeded even to take over the power, and there was a communist government in the end of 1918 and beginning of 1919, which lasted for exactly 101 days in Hungary. But after the consolidation swept through that area of Europe, the communist leaders all left their countries, escaped, and went back to the Soviet Union, and most of them spent their time in the Soviet Union in exile between the two world wars. Now, as during the course of the Second World War, the Soviet army penetrated into the Central and Eastern European countries, the army brought back the exiled communist leaders to their respective countries. And as soon as the army succeeded to liberate a certain part of a Central and Eastern European country, it gave the assignment to the returning communist leaders to initiate a new national political and economic life in their respective countries. So, the initiative after the war for a new political life was given into the hands of the communist returning communist leaders, and they were supported by all the means the occupation army could give to them. Of course, in most of the countries, they weren't able to establish immediately a communist government in spite of the backing of the Red Army, simply because there were no communists in those countries. Consequently, they decided to call to the non-Nazi political parties to establish a coalition government. And I think this coalition business of the with the communists deserve a little attention, because still the question of coalition with the communists are coming up very often, and outside powers would like to establish some order in ideologically troubled countries in the world. We have learned that in a coalition, not the party which has the strongest popular support is the strongest political factor. In a coalition government established by outside power or powers, those political groups are the strongest, even without without any popular support, who are backed and supported by that outside power which placed it into the coalition group. In Hungary, Secretary. We had free elections in 1945. We had free elections because we started a negotiation with the Soviet Union for a free elections immediately after the Yalta Agreement, learning something about the favorable provisions of the agreement to the Central and Eastern European countries. And at that time, the Soviet Union still didn't know how strongly the other other allies, Great Britain and United States, will press for the compliance with these provisions. Consequently, they didn't refuse us, couldn't refuse us with our request of a negotiation for elections. We had free elections, I would say. The result of the elections was disastrous for the Communist Party, because in Hungary, in spite of the presence of the Red Army, about 500,000 Soviet troops in a small country, my party, the Smallholders' Party alone, received 58% of the total votes, and with the other non-communist parties together, 83% of the people voted for non-communist parties, only 17% voted for the Communist Party at that time, when still the Communist Party didn't show any brutalities, any insult and on national traditions, historical values. At that time, when the Communist Party still appeared as the most radical but definitely nationalistic party. At the time of the Hungarian elections, there was only one other country which had non-communist prime minister, was Czechoslovakia. A few months later, even in Czechoslovakia, there was no a non-communist prime minister anymore. In the beginning, or the second half, rather, 1946, when I looked around in Central and Eastern Europe, I found that I am the only non-communist prime minister in the whole Central and Eastern European area, although I knew that in every country, exactly or even bigger portion of the population would take this similar step the Hungarian people have taken had they have free elections in their countries. But the result of the Hungarian elections advised the Soviet Union not to permit any more free elections in Central and Eastern Europe. There were elections, but in most of the elections, the voters were prevented to vote for their according to their will. In most of the elections, the leaders of the opposition were either imprisoned or killed, like Nikola Petkov in Bulgaria. 150 Peasant Party candidates in Poland were imprisoned. So there were no more free elections in the whole Central and Eastern European area, except in Czechoslovakia, where there was no occupation army, and which was regarded as not a defeated or occupied country, but an alliance. But unfortunately, the division of the small of the democratic forces into small groups in Czechoslovakia resulted that the Communist Party became the largest single party in the country, and Mr. Gottwald became the prime minister, the leader of the Communist Party, prime minister of Czechoslovakia. After the result of the Hungarian elections, the main concern of the Communist Party and the Soviet Union was to eliminate the majority in Hungary with all the means. We went through all those Soviet and communist brutalities to eliminate the majority, which you have read in the books. We went through all the so-called conspiracy cases, trials on Soviet pattern, which are so known from the case of Kamenev, Zinoviev in the Soviet Union, later Chuhashevsky in the Soviet Union, and finally they succeeded to take over the power in Hungary also. The takeover in Central and Eastern Europe was followed by the most brutal Bolshevization of the nations. First of all, the elimination of the non-communist political parties, liquidation of their leaders, then the nationalization of the economy, collectivization of the land, oppression of the press, the public opinion, prosecution of the churches, all those bloody details the Soviet people went through became the fate of the Central and Eastern European nations also. The situation became in the Central and Eastern European countries that the gallows and prisons became regular government institutions. After 1953, after Stalin's death, a new leadership emerged in the Soviet Union, and a certain change in the atmosphere occurred in the whole communist world, at that time even in China. That was the time when Mao Zedong was talking about 100 flowers and 100 schools. The Hungarian people took the advantage of the momentan relaxation and, provoked by the communist regime, did try the impossible and staged a revolt in the October of 1956. The result is known. The revolution was crushed by the Soviet Union because the Soviet Union found that there was no officially expressed interest from the part of the Western world. But the Hungarian revolution wasn't entirely in vain. No matter how cruelly the regime prosecuted those who were participating in the revolution, they never succeeded to push back the Hungarian people into that constant fear they lived in. They simply didn't afraid as much as before the revolution. In the meantime, in the oppressing country, in the Soviet Union, certain difficulties were rising, and the Soviet Union could not prevent certain liberalization in the Central and Eastern European countries. The Central and Eastern European nations did try to take advantage of the worsening position of the Soviet Union in world politics and in world economy, and try to achieve as much liberalization as they could. Now, when American newspaper men or commentators are spending 3-4 days in Budapest or Warsaw enjoying the royal hospitality of the communist regime, they are writing articles and sending reports about basic changes in the life of the Central and Eastern European countries. Of course, this is not true in this sense. But what happened in Central and Eastern Europe, which resulted in the present situation? You remember, ladies and gentlemen, that in 1958, Mr. Khrushchev, through a television interview made by the CBS television network in the Kremlin, declared an economic competition with the United States of America. He said that in 5 years, because they are always thinking in 5 years terms, in 5 years, the production of the Soviet Union in bread, vegetables, dairy products, poultry, eggs, will be higher than the production of the United States. And a few weeks later, he added that in a few more years, even the state will be bigger than in the United States. At the end, exactly at the end of the 5 years when Mr. Khrushchev should have announced the result of the competition, he hastily accepted an American proposition to sign an atomic, partial atomic test ban treaty with the Western world. Everybody was a little bit puzzled, but he knew what he is doing. A few weeks after the signature of this atomic test ban treaty, he sold Russian gold for $700 million and gave the money to a trade delegation and sent this delegation to Canada, Australia, and to the United States to buy wheat because the Soviet economy, Soviet agriculture wasn't able to produce enough bread to the Soviet people. That was the end of the competition. The Soviet Union began to realize that the Soviet economy became, without being able to solve the problem of living standard, a vast, huge economy which cannot be handled anymore by communistic methods, and it's better to try to establish an atmosphere in the world politics which would make possible more than a coexistence with the Western world, maybe a kind of cooperation. There was another trouble emerging for the Soviet Union, and that is the Sino-Soviet conflict. Many people still do not realize the seriousness of this conflict. It is quite serious, and I don't see any possibility or any basis for a lasting reconciliation between the two countries, because the differences are not based on ideological differences. They are based on the sharply opposing interest of two big nations, China and Russia. The Chinese communist regime is claiming 580,000 square miles of Soviet territories because the population of China is increasing in an uncontrollable tempo, and there is only one country with vast uninhabited territories which in the Chinese interpretation is still holding 580,000 square miles of Chinese territories in possession. The Soviet Union began to realize that for her, China is the real danger and not the Western world. Of course, the Central and Eastern European regimes did everything to take advantage of these political difficulties of the Soviet Union also. But there is a third trouble inside which is common in the whole communist world. They are losing ground ideologically. More and more intellectuals, progressive intellectuals in the world, not only in the Western world, but even in the underdeveloped countries, even behind the Iron Curtain in the communist world, are realizing that communism is not the progressive revolutionary ideology it was believed to be 10 or 15 years ago. It is getting an obsolete, rather reactionary ideology, which is not able to answer the most natural aspirations of mankind. And they are losing interest in communism. All these phenomena are troubling, of course, the Soviet politics, and the Soviet Union feels that it would be better to buy a peace on the Western front to be able to face the economic and ideological difficulties and to be able to face with full attention the growing danger of China. The Central and Eastern European countries went as far as they could to achieve the degree of the interest of the leaders in the people as they could to make the life of the people easier. They would like to broaden their trade relations with the Western world because it would be cheaper for them than to trade with the Soviet Union, which is, through the trade agreement, practicing a brutal price discrimination and exploitation of the Central and Eastern European countries. But they would like to do this without losing the political and military protection of the Soviet Union against their own peoples. They would like to pay less to the Soviet Union for keeping them in power in their respective countries, but they wouldn't like to lose entirely the security of the Soviet Union behind them, because many of them wouldn't even last for weeks if the Soviet Union would withdraw its political and military support from them. Now, in this situation, I still feel that I have all the rights to express optimism as to the future fate of the Central and Eastern European nations. I feel that the international situation will be developing in a way when the Soviet Union must give certain concessions to the free world in Central and Eastern Europe. I feel that when the time will come when the Soviet Union wants to buy peace from the West on the Western Front, the Western world will be prepared not to give this security and peace free of charge, but will demand certain changes and improvements in the life of the Central and Eastern European nations. Of course, those nations are expecting the initiative, first of all, from the United States of America. They are expecting this initiative from here because they are realizing that no other power is in the position to initiate basic changes in world politics. They are expecting that if the Vietnamese war will end with the minimum goal of the United States, which will secure the independence and neutrality of South Vietnam, and thus put an end, at least temporarily, of the communist expansion in Southeast Asia, the Soviet Union and the Central and Eastern European governments will resume immediately their negotiations with the Western world for a better relation and for a cooperation, at least in economic and cultural fields. What the Central and Eastern European nations are afraid from is that if the American military forces will leave South Vietnam without achieving that minimum goal, then a communist expansion will start in the whole Southeast Asian area, and it will make again impossible any new approach between the greatest communist power, the Soviet Union, and the greatest Western power, the United States of America. They are afraid that if the Soviet Union must participate in a communist expansion after an American withdrawal from South Vietnam, must participate in order to curtail the influence of China, then the United States will not be in the position to negotiate with them. And when the communist expansion will threaten the takeover of the whole Southeast Asian area, that will be the first definite step toward a third world war, because the Western world could not tolerate to lose the whole Central and Southeast Asia to communism. But they hope that the American government will try to achieve its minimum goal and will try to achieve an atmosphere in which a somber negotiation can be resumed. Algerian people, but maybe after the terrible bitterness they have felt after the 1956 revolution, is recovering its sense and realizing that their great leader of the 19th century, Louis Kossuth, who after losing the great freedom fight of 1848-49 came to the United States in exile, made a statement, and the Hungarian people believed that he was right when he said that this, in spite of all the troubles in the world, mankind still lucky that there is a God in heaven and an America on the earth. Thank you very much.
Mr. Premier, our applause conveys our approval of your presentation and certainly our gratitude for what you have told us, and also our warm support for your cause, which is also our cause. I would like to make two announcements. Premier Nyes will be in the faculty lounge for informal discussions with faculty members this afternoon at 2:30. I understand that he will also address a history class at 1:30 this afternoon. And he will be in the student lounge from 3:30 to 4:30 this afternoon for informal discussion with students. It is my hope that as you have reflected your interest by your mass attendance this morning, which I think is a very appropriate thing for this college, particularly for young men who must become leaders of the future, if you have additional interests and would like to discuss subjects which you would like to raise, you will have this opportunity between 3:30 and 4:30 this afternoon in the Commons Lounge, and we invite your participation.